Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 97.9 The Wren. The wake-up call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And thank you, everyone. Sunday morning wake-up call back for another program for something that is in the news and has been in the news for quite some time now. We're going to talk about redistricting in the state of Virginia. Our guest today, Liz White. She's the executive director at One Virginia 2021. We'll have her explain in a moment exactly what they've been doing, but it bears through gerrymandering. And the constitutional amendment that many people voted for in November, the past, present, and future status of Virginia's redistricting plans. Ms. White, welcome to the program.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, we're always pleased to have folks honor us for our hour on Sunday mornings. One Virginia 2021 has been around for much longer than since January of 2021. How long has the organization been around?
We were founded in 2013, right there in Charlottesville by Lee Middleditch, who is the founder of many, many good government organizations and is a visionary. And he gathered up some leaders from all over the state and all over the political spectrum, in around 2012. And all of them agreed that the way Virginia had been drawing their district lines was unfair and, behind closed doors and smoky back rooms, and it wasn't right for the citizens. And no matter how you identified politically, you could acknowledge there was a much better way to go about doing this. And they all got together and created One Virginia 2021.
When you say they all got together, was this a, I'll use the word, although I've grown tired of it, is this a partisan group that got together?
This was what we affectionately call a multi-partisan group. It was everyone from former and current and former electeds on the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. It was a founder of the statewide Tea Party. It was a leader in the libertarian movement. I mean, there were just folks from kind of all parts of political life and all parts of the political belief system who probably didn't agree on much else and could come together and agree on this.
So 2020 comes around, and one of the constitutional amendments that was on the ballot was what was listed as Constitutional Amendment Number 1. Can you remind everyone who voted and who might have paid attention in the news and tell others who might not have been in Virginia, who weren't able to pay, be aware, Constitutional Amendment Number 1.
Sure. So Amendment 1 created the first ever Virginia Redistricting Commission, and it is a hybrid structure. We're the first of its kind in the country. It is made up of 16 people, 8 of whom are sitting legislators and 8 of whom are citizens. It is divided evenly among partisan lines. It is divided. The legislators are divided evenly between House and Senate. There is transparency baked in at every step along the way. There's a lot of room for public input and public participation. There are citizen chairs of the commission, so it's citizen-led, just an unprecedented voice for non-electeds in this process, and a lot of sunlight in the system that was never there before. The amendment also enshrined Voting Rights Act-style language in the state constitution, which, you know, in case anyone is concerned that the Federal Voting Rights Act could get further gutted by the Supreme Court, this is a really comforting backstop.
Explain that part a little bit. How does the Voting Rights Act play a role in this constitutional amendment?
Sure. So the Federal Voting Rights Act of 1965 some of it has been struck down by the courts in recent years, but part of it that is still around says that districts should be drawn so that a minority group, if possible, should be able to elect a representative of their choosing. So you have to, if you can draw a district that would have, that would be majority minority and allow a racial, ethnic, or language group to have a say, a pretty solid say in who they get to represent them, you are required by law to do so. And Amendment 1 included language like that, that is now in the Virginia Constitution. So even if the federal law were to get struck down, the state law would still stand and those protections would still exist.
Now, almost two-thirds of voting Virginians back in November of 2020 voted yes for this amendment, correct?
They sure did. Almost every locality voted yes.
And One Virginia, as an organization, One Virginia 2021, was for this amendment?
We were for this amendment. And in fact, we spun off a separate entity that became the Vote Yes campaign called Fairmaps VA. And our former executive director, Brian Cannon, went and led that Vote Yes effort. I became the executive director of the foundation then, which was purely became an educational wing. And we focused a lot on voting rights and voting information, and, you know, especially in a really interesting and unusual voting period last year, became super important. But yes, One Virginia was full-throatedly supportive.
But once the work went into, after the amendment was voted in, I don't know if that's the proper jargon, there was a split amongst the Virginia legislature as to whether or not to support or oppose. Actually, I didn't phrase that very well. Before November, the Virginia legislature had a split as to whether or not support or oppose this amendment. Can you talk about why?
Sure. So we know historically in Virginia that both parties have been guilty of gerrymandering as recently as 2011, which was a split map. So there's no... no party really has the monopoly on gerrymandering or, you know, the monopoly on virtue in this issue. In 2019, those of us who've been working on redistricting reform for really for decades, there's people who've been working on this much, much longer than One Virginia has been around. We really got like a perfect political storm in 2019 because it was such a year that no one could accurately predict or comfortably predict who was going to have the majority in either chamber the following year. And the following year in 2020, that's going to be that legislature would be the ones to draw the maps in the old system. So because no one could comfortably say that they were going to be in charge when map drawing time came around, everyone was able to hedge their bets a little bit with supporting some kind of reform that would at least protect them from the other side gerrymandering them. And that is not to say, that sounds like a lot of, you know, crass political calculation. And that, I don't mean to downplay the support of several members of the legislature who have always sincerely supported redistricting reform. There are plenty of them on both sides of the aisle and in both chambers. But I think the reason it passed so overwhelmingly in 2019 is it takes 2 years to pass a constitutional amendment in Virginia. And so that first one was a little bit of a gimme, and everyone felt safe doing it. And then in 2020, majorities changed, political calculus changed, and I think it became a harder sell to a majority party and a much easier sell to a minority party. And I think that that always happens is the party in charge is the one being asked to give up an incredible political weapon. And I really give a lot of credit to those members of the majority party who did vote for this amendment ultimately. I think that was a really, really, brave, courageous. It was a really incredible thing that they did to say, it's not right when my team does it either, and to proceed with that vote.
Liz White with us today. She's the executive director at One Virginia 21. You can find the website at One, O-N-E, Virginia, 2021foundation.org and learn more about them. Talk about Virginia redistricting and the redistricting commission that's now in action. So, Liz, in the pre-election vote for Virginia redistricting, and by that I mean in November to the general public, what I read was that most Senate Democrats in the General Assembly strongly supported the amendment. And most House Democrats were opposed. But 9 House Democrats joined with 45 House Republicans to pass the amendment and get it sent to the voters for the ballot.
Yes.
And the word you used, it seemed as though you struggled a bit to find the right word, was brave. So the question that I have is, if your party wants to be known stereotypically, as the Democrats do, for voter rights, fairness, etc., how can you be against gerrymandering until you hold power to draw district lines? What were these other Democratic legislative members of the House using as their excuse to vote against the amendment?
That's a really good question. And I think certainly in some cases you'd probably have to ask them what was on their minds. I know that the House Legislative Black Caucus raised a lot of concerns, and to their credit, they raised those concerns the first year as well. They were not new concerns because of their majority party status. And I think that their concerns were mostly that they weren't being considered enough and they weren't being looked out for enough, and that this amendment didn't go far enough to ensure that the historic levels of marginalization in the redistricting process would not continue. I think that especially Black communities in Virginia can look at their history and have every reason to be concerned that they would be left out of these decisions, that they would be used as pawns in these decisions. We had 2 federal lawsuits just this last year, one about congressional districts and one about House of Delegates districts, that ruled 2011 maps to be racial gerrymanders. And they were in the second half of the decade, which already means that these Black communities were living in unconstitutional districts for more than a half a decade and having their vote and their influence diluted. So I'm not trying to say that they didn't have legitimate concerns or that they didn't have legitimate reasons to oppose the amendment. And I think a lot of the Democrats in the House were well-meaning and were trying to listen to the Black Caucus and vote in a way they thought would be helpful to them. And I know that there were a lot of concerns about what this would mean for Democrats statewide, what this would mean for their majority, what would happen if the commission deadlocked and the map drawing job got sent to the Supreme Court of Virginia. A lot of people viewed that to be a very conservative body and were worried that the maps would end up just being a Republican gerrymander. I don't think that's true. I think that, and even if you don't want to take my word for it, the legislature did pass legislation in 2020 to put a lot of safeguards on the Supreme Court should the map drawing end up there. They have to hire two special masters to draw the maps, one recommended by Democrats, one recommended by Republicans. They have to have a lot of transparency. They have to follow the same criteria. So I think that that concern is maybe overblown, but it was certainly there.
So how did One Virginia 2021 work with the legislators in getting them to vote? Because you talk about sort of educating the general public. Did you work at all with the individual representatives and senators and speak with them?
We did. As an organization, we certainly did. I will say that that was never my particular bailiwick. So I'm certainly not the most knowledgeable about exactly how those operations worked. But I know we worked closely with several legislators throughout the years. I mean, we had different versions of redistricting reform legislation for every session I can remember. And I came on board in 2015. And so there was a lot of collaboration. There was a lot of kind of forming bipartisan alliances within the House, within the Senate, across the chamber lines. And you mentioned it's education for the general public, but in a lot of cases, it was education for the legislators as well. And I still find that unless they have been on the Privileges and Elections Committees and followed this issue really carefully, it's such a thorny, sprawling, issue that there's still a lot to learn for most legislators, and certainly most members of the public, and honestly, for us as well. But we've had some really strong allies, and they've done a lot of recruiting, bringing people to their way of thinking, a lot of educating, a lot of, our kind of allies in the General Assembly, they did a lot of educating within their caucus.
Again, our guest today is Liz White. She's the executive director at One Virginia 2021. We're going to go ahead and take our break because the next several questions are going to require more than a 60-second reply, I think. So let's do that. Let's take our break. We'll come back and we'll continue our conversation on how the amendment works in itself. And by that, I mean how the judges do their thing, how the commission was formed, and who does what job. Be right back. And here we are, Virginia redistricting with Liz White from One Virginia 2021. With the goal being to take gerrymandering off the table here in Virginia. So, Liz, we mentioned earlier about the new redistricting commission here in the state of Virginia and how the commission was meant to be set up based on the amendment itself. Can you get a little more detail going for us?
Absolutely. So there were a lot of people involved in ultimately selecting the 16 members of this hybrid commission, the 8 legislators and the 8 citizens. The first thing that happened right after Election Day, right after this passed and, the results were certified, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Virginia had to reach out to all of his retired circuit court judges and find out who would be willing to serve on the Citizen Selection Committee. Of all of the ones who said that they would be willing, that list was sent to each of the 4 legislative leaders from the General Assembly. So the Speaker of the House and the Minority Leader in the House, the Senate Pro Tem of the Senate, and the Minority Leader in the Senate. Those 4 leaders each picked one judge from that list, and then those 4 judges put their heads together and got to pick a 5th from that list to be their chair. Everything that panel did was live streamed. And I want to note too that based on the supplemental legislation that was passed in 2020 around the amendment, one of the provisions, well, several of the provisions, there, every step of the way, there was a requirement that people making decisions should consider the racial, ethnic, gender, and geographic diversity of the Commonwealth. So even with this panel of five judges, you had that diversity, which was great to see right off the bat. I thought they did a great job. They took their job very seriously. They really felt the weight of the moment and this inaugural body that they were part of. So once they were selected, they got to determine the application process, and all of this was very quick. The application process started at the end of November and ran through December 28th. So especially when you factor holidays in there, it was a pretty quick turnaround. One Virginia worked with a lot of other active groups and did a lot of outreach to ensure that the pool of applicants was, one, big enough to really be able to field some great candidates. And also the pool of candidates reflected the diversity of the Commonwealth and made it possible for the ultimate selection to do the same. So halfway through, VPAP reported that only 88 people had applied for this commission. And so we went, well, that's not nearly enough. And we redoubled our efforts, along again with other groups, the League of Women Voters, et cetera. And we, ultimately almost 1300 people applied to serve on this commission, which was just extraordinary to see all of those Virginians step up to be willing to serve, to do something like this. So those same four legislative leaders I mentioned before got to look at the full pool of applicants, and they each made a list of at least 16 finalists. They sent those lists to the five judges. The five judges got to pick two from each list, and there you get your final eight. Now, those four legislative leaders each got to also pick two members of their own caucus, so you end up with two Democratic senators, two Republican senators, two Democratic delegates, two Republican delegates, and those are your eight legislators. So everyone was selected by mid to late January. It's all a blur now. What is time in this pandemic time?
So it does. It sounds very transparent and very open, and it moved quite speedily. I did do a little reading about the those who were selected. There were a lot of people with legal backgrounds. It seemed as though judges had selected many with a legal background. Was that necessary? Was that focused on? Or did that just happen? Or was that people picking people that they knew sort of thing?
I don't know for sure. I would guess that there's, and I'm sure that there's data we could go back and look at. I'm going to guess there was probably an outsized proportion of lawyers who applied to be on a commission like this, probably having some comfort with the legal world, made people more willing to imagine that they could handle this and they could, you know, perform this task. Even unconsciously, I wouldn't doubt that legislators and judges probably went, well, that person knows what they're doing. I can't speak to that for sure, but it wouldn't surprise me. But yes, there's a lot of lawyers on there.
Yeah. The Roanoke Times made the claim that Southwest Virginia was unrepresented.
It is really unfortunate the way it ended up panning out. One, there weren't a ton of applicants from Southwest Virginia proportionally. There were, I forget what the final number was, but we, you know, redoubled our efforts out there. And I know a lot of other groups did as well, and tried to make sure we had some great candidates to choose from. And the judges, again, in their, you know, live streamed conversation, they were very mindful about geographic diversity. I mean, they were really mindful about, honestly, racial and geographic diversity, ultimately not so much on the gender, but, that's of all those things, certainly the hardest thing to gerrymander is gender. But they were very, very conscious about making sure that someone from Southwest Virginia was on the commission. And it was a man named Marvin Gilliam from Bristol. And So originally, there was representation for Southwest Virginia. And unfortunately, a couple of months ago, Mr. Gilliam resigned from the commission for personal reasons. He did not specify. But I do know that Bristol is a very, very long way away from Richmond, and he was going to be having to go to Richmond a lot. So not to put words in his mouth or anything, but I know that it'd be hard to begrudge that amount of mileage. But so once Mr. Gilliam stepped down, the other 15 commissioners went back to that list of 16 that Mr. Gilliam had been selected from. And from those remaining names, anyone who was still willing to serve, they were able to pick a replacement. And I know that in their discussions, because they had their discussions in a public meeting, they also were very conscious of geographic diversity. And they ended up picking the newest commissioner. Her name is Virginia Trost Thornton. She's from Forest, which is certainly not Southwest Virginia. And interestingly enough, is the same city that Senator Steve Newman comes from. So there was already representation from Forest. But comments were made that would indicate to me that they kind of felt that was the closest geographically that they could get. They're very, very conscious of the fact that Southwest Virginia does not have representation at the on the commission itself. And I think it's really important to also reiterate that just because there isn't someone in that group of 16 from Southwest Virginia does not mean that Southwest Virginia doesn't have a voice. There's so much room for public input and public comment and public participation that I really, really hope and I really encourage residents of Southwest Virginia to speak up, because even better than one person from Southwest Virginia in the room is 100 people from Southwest Virginia saying, this is what our region needs. This is the community we live in. This is how you can keep us together. This is what we would like to see in these maps. I think there's still a way for Southwest Virginia and every community in Virginia to really still be heard and honored and taken care of in this process.
So we have our commission now, and what are the deadlines that they're faced with?
Well, I'm glad you asked. So we know that census data recently was finally released. It is usually something that we get in the spring, and Virginia and New Jersey usually get it even a little ahead of everyone else because we're the only ones with our odd year elections. So usually we get it much, much earlier than we did, but because of the pandemic, it only arrived on August 12th. And at a commission meeting this past week, the commissioners discussed with their two sets of legal counsel. They do have Republican legal counsel and Democratic legal counsel, both of whom represent the entire commission. They're not divided into teams. But they do get advice from both sides. And they had a big, robust discussion about what exactly should be their start date, because the amendment, and now the Constitution, specifies that the commission has 45 days from the receipt of the census data to submit House of Delegates and State Senate maps to the General Assembly for a vote. So the question was around, what does receipt of census data mean? So because of the pandemic and this weird decade and these weird circumstances around the federal census, not only was it did it come months later than usual, but it's also coming twice, kind of. So we had the option to get this data on August 12th. It's going to be released again on September 30th. The data is identical, but it's in a different format. So we are getting it in what they call legacy format, and it's the same format they used in 2011. I am not enough of a techie to fully explain why it would take another 6 weeks to convert the data into the new format, but Virginia was given the option and they jumped on the chance to have this data earlier rather than later. All of their software can still read it, but it is going to take about 2 weeks for the data to be inputted into their map drawing software properly. And then Virginia also has the added wrinkle in the time frame. The General Assembly passed legislation in 2020 that bans prison gerrymandering. And that means formerly incarcerated people were counted in the district where they are incarcerated. And now they are counted at their last known address. So because they are a population that is unable to vote, the argument is that it's gerrymandering because that district that contains the prison or the jail, the voters end up having an outsized voice because, you know, imagine you have 100 people and 50 of them are prisoners who can't vote, but they're still counted the same way 100 people in another district are. Those 50 extra people basically get two votes. So that's a very simplistic way to break it down. But because we've also added that wrinkle into our system this year, we need a little extra time to get the data from the Department of Corrections and make all of those adjustments. So it is going to be about a full 2 weeks before the commission has usable data, before they have actually received census data that they can use to draw maps. So the decision was made to count August 26th, which is 2 weeks after that August 12th release from the U.S. Census Bureau. August 26th will be the start date. So the 45-day clock to submit the maps for the General Assembly districts to the General Assembly for a vote starts then, which was a really long answer to a pretty simple question.
Well, there's a lot that has to go into figuring that out, it seems like. But one of the rules, laws, regulations is that the commission must get feedback from the public, correct?
Yes, and probably one of the most important provisions.
But what good... help me, what public comments are needed for if fairness is the goal?
That's a great question. One of the criteria, there was a bill passed in 2020 that laid out the criteria that now legally must be used for whoever was drawing the maps, whether it was going to be a commission or the General Assembly or whomever. And one of the criteria that they have to use is communities of interest. Now, redistricting reformers and, you know, advocates all over the country use this phrase, communities of interest. Virginia, I think, is one of the lucky states that has it now in our code that we have to use this consideration. A community of interest is kind of an intentionally vague term. It's any geographically contiguous group of people with shared interests. The only thing it specifies is that you can't define it as is a political group. So you can't say we're a community because we all vote for this one person, or we're a community because we all vote Republican or Democrat or whatever. But other than that, the definition is kind of left up to all of us. So because they have to consider those communities of interest, they need to hear from all of us what those communities of interest are. So some of them are a little easier to measure because you can say, oh, this community of interest is maybe a racial, ethnic, or language group. And there's a Vietnamese population in Prince William County, and we're going to make sure that we account for that community and we don't carve them up. We've gotten a lot of feedback throughout this process that the city of Lynchburg, a lot of the residents have said, please keep us together in one piece. We don't want to be split up. Residents of Fredericksburg have kind of said the same thing. So to some people, their community of interest is their city. We've seen people stand up and say, there's a district line that runs right through the middle of my HOA. And so she could argue her HOA, her neighborhood, is her community. And I hear from a lot of people that they don't think anything that they would have to say would be helpful to this commission. And I just think there's nothing too obvious to tell them. It might seem really obvious to you what your community is, or really obvious to you how your area should be districted. You know, if you're going to do it fairly, it's obviously going to be like this. But there are only 16 people, and they, even with the best of intentions, they can't know every corner of the state. And they they are really well served by a lot of information. So the more you can tell them about the needs of your community and what you think the boundaries of your community should be, the better they are able to keep your community together, which helps ensure that your community, your influence isn't diluted, and you're all able to look to the same person when you have a question, or the same person when you have a need, or if something happens, or there's a disaster in your area, and someone in the General Assembly has the job of looking out for your community, and it's not two or three people who have the job of looking out for a sliver of your community, but also a lot of other communities that come before yours. So anything you can tell them is helpful. You don't have to be a mapping expert. You don't have to be a political science expert. No one knows your community like you do. There are ways to draw your community online. There's free tools. They're all on our website. There are ways you can just write to them and say, you know, especially if it's my community is the city of fill in the blank. That's a really easy thing. That takes 2 minutes. And they really do read the public comment. And especially if you can get, you know, get your friends, get your book club, get your PTA, get your network to also write to them, they hear it from a lot of people and they remember it and they go, wow, we really need to make sure that this line doesn't cut through this community.
Again, our guest today, Liz White, Executive Director at One Virginia 2021, as we talk about the Virginia Redistricting Commission. We'll be right back. And thanks for being with us today, talking about the Virginia Redistricting Commission. After the constitutional amendment was voted in November of 2020, Liz White with us. So Liz, you were telling us about feedback from the public to the commission. You can go to the virginiaredistricting.org website if you're a listener and check out what sort of public comments are needed if fairness is the goal. And so I wanted to go through these a little bit, both for the listeners and for myself. The first one listed is what bonds your community. Seems like a fair question. You went through that, shaking my head in a positive manner. Number two, what do you see as the common links in your community? I'm wondering, you know, that seems like it might be open to some politics there for answers to people. Folks on my side of the train tracks attend the same social clubs or go to the same church or have the same beliefs.
I think that's right. I think it is certainly open to all of the things you said. I would note two things. I think one, if that's your community and that's what you want to tell the commission, that's okay. You want to say we all go to the same social club, or we all go to the same rec center, or we all go to the same high school football games. That's all okay. The commission can choose whether or not they're able to honor a request like that, or if they consider that a community of interest, but it shouldn't stop you from telling them if you feel that that is your community of interest. And the other thing I would note is that you're not being asked to draw a district when you talk about your community of interest. You're not saying we all go to the same social clubs and we should have our very own delegate, because probably your social club doesn't have quite enough people to be a whole legislative district. But what you are asking is, even if you are just a small part of a bigger district, you would still like to be together. You don't necessarily want a line drawn through the center of your community when that could be avoided.
Next one is, where is your community located? Like you talked about, some cities or folks in cities may not want districts through their city limits. Number four, how do you define the boundaries of your community? I thought that seemed open to possible redlining.
I think, again, it's easier to define in some places than others. I think if you're in a more urban area, it's probably, you're probably able to say my community, you know, where I shop, where I eat, where my kids go to school, where all my friends live, whatever your sphere is, you know, where my grocery store is, you probably have an idea. You know, it goes up to Main Street and over to Fifth Street, whatever those streets are in your city. And you might be able to define them that specifically. You might live out in a more rural area and the boundaries of your community are everyone who lives along this stretch of highway because you all share economic interests. If you live in a populated center, it might be the boundaries of your community or everyone who's commuting into DC and it, you know, this part of your town really does that. Maybe this part of your town stays put. It really is, there are no wrong answers and there are millions of correct answers.
The last two, why should your community be kept together and why should your community be kept separate from another community or area, I guess, receive similar answers as to what you just gave us for feedback.
Yeah, and I think there are, I tend to phrase this question slightly differently when I talk to people. I say, what would make life better for your community? Like, why should you be kept together? What does your community need from its representative? What would make your life better? The other question I really like to ask people, because I think it's just a natural segue to getting them to talk about their area and their lives within it. I say, if someone were about to move in next door from far away, what would you tell them about your community? Where would you tell them to shop and eat and worship? And what cultural centers would you point them to? You know, where would you take them to meet new friends? What would you tell them about your kids' school? Everyone knows those things. So think about someone moving in and what you would tell them. And that probably informs what your community of interest is. And if you can't imagine a practical reason to have a big district line drawn through the middle of that, then that's probably worth telling the commission.
Again, Liz White with us, Executive Director of One Virginia 2021, as we talk about Virginia redistricting and the new redistricting commission. Liz, what is the Sunlight District's challenge?
So as we've talked about, I think there's a lot of threshold anxiety for people to talk about their community of interest. And so we were trying to think of fun ways to make this accessible and just lower that participation threshold so that anyone who has something to say can find an easy way to say it. And we've got a bunch of ways to submit written comment. We've got a 2-minute survey you can fill out if that's the time you have to spare, which I understand. I have two small kids. But the Sunlight Districts, we like the idea of, you know, it's summertime. It's a fun social media giveaway. And we're bringing sunlight. Virginia has brought redistricting into the sunlight, out of the smoky back rooms, into transparency. And it's the Sunlight District's challenge offers you a big cooler full of summer toys and goodies to one lucky person who enters. And there's a bunch of ways you can enter. You can share comments or share content on social media, help us spread the word about the public hearings and about the ways to engage with the commission and about just the goings on of the commission in general. So any help to spread the word is much appreciated. And then the other thing you can do is pick up your smartphone, you know, start a video, talk about your community for a minute, minute and a half, as long as you need. And then you can either send that directly to us at sunlight@onevirginia2021.org, or you can post it online on any social media platform, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, because we are not young and hip enough to use anything beyond that. But those three, you can post it with the hashtag SunlightDistrictsVA. And after Labor Day, we'll pick a lucky winner and disperse those goodies.
And if folks need to figure all that out on their own and read all about it again, you can go to the website, One, that's O-N-E, Virginia, 2021, foundation.org. So Liz, let's talk for a bit for about the future. Can you tell me what changes you expect in the short term from this redistricting? Let's say short term, the next few elections.
Sure. It's hard to predict what the outcomes of any new maps are going to be. And I know One Virginia has never been, we've never been outcome oriented. We've very much been focused on a fair process. So I don't know that I'm able to make any predictions about, you know, who gets the majority, who gets reelected, what the districts look like. What I think will come out of this commission, and what I think is part of what is so much better than the old system, is one, we will understand why the lines are where they are. I think you're going to see just maps that make more sense. There's a lot of times where you can look at a close up of any number of legislative districts in Virginia. You can certainly look at the congressional map. I know you all are in the 5th district, and it, you know, spans from North Carolina almost all the way up to West Virginia. So you kind of look at these maps and you go, well, why? That makes no sense. So one, we'll understand the lines, and I think you'll be able to just understand by looking at them why they were placed that way. Communities will be whole. I think we'll probably see an uptick in competitive seats because there won't be as much racial or political, you know, packing people into districts or intentionally diluting populations to break up communities of influence. So I think you're going to see a lot of better maps for the public, for sure. And I don't know how it's going to look for legislators. The commissioners are working their way through a series of decisions right now about exactly how they're going to draw the maps. You know, the real nitty gritty work plan, who's in the room, who clicks the mouse, who decides what line to put where. They've just finalized their criteria and guidelines, which fleshes out the legislation passed in 2020 and really lays out what they're going to prioritize and in what order. But I really encourage people to engage in these meetings. It's getting exciting. The clock is starting, and the more you can weigh in on the process or on the maps themselves, the better. But I definitely think we're going to see fairer, more logical, more representative districts for Virginia.
So one of the, again, rules of the amendment is that if the commission cannot finalize it, then it moves to the Virginia Supreme Court. If it can't be accomplished by the committee, Virginia Supreme Court has responsibility if there's failure. Do you envision that taking place?
So there's two eventualities where the Supreme Court ends up with the job of establishing the maps. And as I said, the justices are not going to be sitting around drawing maps. They are legally required to hire 2 special masters approved by each party and abide by the same criteria. If the commission has these 45 days to draw the maps, they have to pass the maps with a supermajority of both citizens and legislators. So 6 out of the 8 citizens have to vote for these maps, and 6 out of 8 legislators have to vote for the maps. And there's one further caveat. If the 2 no votes, if 6 out of 8 legislators vote for a map, the 2 no votes can't be the two members of the same caucus if that map being drawn is from their chamber, which I did not say clearly at all. Let me give an example. If, for example, we're talking about the House of Delegates map, if the 2 no votes are either the two House Democrats or the two House Republicans, the caucuses in essence get a veto. So there can't be any, you know, backroom deals where, the senators, and I'm picking on senators, I'm just picking a house, but, you know, the senators can't go, well, we all look good. We all think that this map is fine. So we're going to cut a deal with one of the parties in the House, and there's your six legislator votes. That can't happen because that other caucus would get a veto. So that long explanation out of the way, if they can pass those maps with 6 out of 8 appropriately, then they go to the General Assembly. If they cannot do that, they get 45 days, and then they have a 14-day grace period built in. But if at the end of that they just can't come together on a map, then it goes to the Supreme Court of Virginia, or it does go over to the General Assembly. The General Assembly has 15 days to vote on it. They get an up or down vote. They are not allowed to make amendments like they have in the past in the old system. They can give notes and give suggestions and say, you know, make floor speeches and say why they don't like it, but they get an up or down vote. If it is a no vote, it goes back to the commission. The commission has 2 weeks to submit something new, to make whatever changes they need to make and submit a new thing. And then the General Assembly gets another 7 days for all of this is on our website for those following along at home. They get another 7 days to do a second up or down vote. If they still do not approve what the commission has sent them, again, it goes to the Supreme Court of Virginia. And again, another thing I would add is that the House and Senate maps have to pass together. So again, there can't be any inter-chamber shenanigans, as I call them. The General Assembly has to pass that package of maps. And then the federal maps, the U.S. House of Representative maps, are their own deal. The commission has a little longer to do them. They will go through as a separate thing. But you asked if I think it's likely if it goes to the court. There's certainly a lot of ways it can end up at the court. I'm still really optimistic that the commission is going to produce maps that everyone can get behind. I think historically, commissions in other states have produced good maps. And are they going to be perfect? Probably not. And we have, as I said, this unique hybrid system where we've got 8 legislators in the room. We're also the first state to have passed reform through our legislature without a citizens initiative to go directly to the ballot. So we still have legislators in the room. But I am very optimistic about the quality of maps that will still come out of this commission. And I also would say that if they end up in the Supreme Court and we have to go with special masters, they're still going to be fair maps. They may not be as those special masters won't be as familiar with Virginia as the commission, but they will still be fair, equitable maps. That's their job. That's what they come in to do. And it'll still be a better result than a single party gerrymandering behind closed doors, which was the old system. So I'm hopeful that the commission will be able to draw the maps because I think that will be the best result. But the Supreme Court option is still a comforting backstop.
All right, so we got about 2 minutes left. Last question. If a map is passed in the General Assembly, do you envision public attempts to prevent enactment in the courts and requiring some form of a redraw?
I don't think so. I think by the time it clears all the hurdles of the bipartisan commission and the General Assembly, I think if all of those people have been able to get on board with whatever the product is, I don't think that anyone is going to be able to find grounds to successfully sue to the point that there needs to be a redraw. Again, historically, commissions all over the country, they don't have their maps sued over. Legislatures get their maps sued about all the time, but commission maps tend to stand because there's been so much bipartisan feedback throughout the process.
I think that both of us are hoping that in the end, we get a fair map for the state. That, I mean, that's just what we want, right? We want fairness in the voting world that can, it's never going to make everyone happy, but the goal is to give voting rights in a fair to the, to in a, the largest amount of populace in a fair way as possible. And we didn't have that before.
We didn't. We've got a voice in this process that we've never had before. We can really influence the maps that are going to stand for the next 10 years.
Liz White with us today, One Virginia 2021. You can go to the website at onevirginia2021foundation.org. You can learn more about the Redistricting Commission at virginiaredistricting.org. Liz, thank you so much for being with us today.
It was my pleasure, Rick. Thank you so much for having me.
All right, folks. Thank you so much. Everyone, be well. We'll talk to you next Sunday.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on Real Oldies 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at cvillepodcast.com. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for The Wake Up Call, only on 97.9 The Wren.